The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
British soccer fans behave badly. They're called Neanderthals, and that is unfair. Neanderthals were highly evolved humans, as you've said. Their brains were as big as ours. They walked upright as well as we do.
Chris Stringer on the twists and turns in human evolution and how Neanderthals have been getting a bad rap. And...
making documentaries about science, it sort of creates what science comes to mean for the public.
We meet filmmaker Julia Barron and public health doctor Ian Roberts to discuss how documentary can help tell the story behind the science. Of course, we've got this week's news as well, including controversial ideas around geoengineering our planet to save it from climactic catastrophe, a ladybird census of the UK that doesn't have good news for native bugs, and a new stem cell-based treatment for eye diseases. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. We start this week with human evolution, the story of how we, Homo sapiens, evolved from our ape-like ancestors and spread across the world is one that's been written, rewritten, and argued about for generations. Every few years, a new fossil, some ancient DNA, or a fragment of primitive art forces scientists to update what they think happened after humans first emerged thousands of years ago. To tell us the scientific story so far, we have Chris Stringer in this studio. He's Britain's foremost expert on human origins and works at the Natural History Museum in London. His new book, The Origin of Our Species, is all about the story of humans. Welcome to the podcast, Chris. Let's just start with this very simple question. Where did we come from?
Well, that is a very good question. And the book, of course, is called The Origin of Our Species. But as I wrote it and thought more about it, it maybe should have been called The Origins of Our Species, because I think what's clear is that the idea that we had a single centre of origin, maybe some small part of Africa, like a Garden of Eden where everything all happened, I used to at times think that was the situation and there would be a single centre for our physical, behavioural, genetic evolution. But I don't think that anymore. I think that different parts of Africa contributed to our origins, and even as we now know from genomic work, even some other hominids outside of Africa contributed a bit to our present makeup.
So the classic story is our species emerged from Africa several thousand years ago and then went on to spread around the world, displace all the other species of humans. Job done. But it's where do the complexities lie? I mean, the first part of it, we emerged out of Africa. What happened next?
Well, okay, I'd even take you up on the classic bit, because of course, as I explain in the book, if we go back 30 or 40 years, no one thought that modern humans originated in Africa. So the classic view was that we evolved from people like the Neanderthals and people like them all over the world. So there was no single continent even of origin for modern humans. So the out of Africa, the recent African origin model, has really developed in the last 30 years. And yes, you could call it now the dominant model. But yes, what we see is that modern humans indeed largely originated in Africa. And then about 60,000 years ago, we started to come out of Africa. People stayed behind, of course, as well. But the intriguing thing is that genomic data shows that when modern humans probably got to the Middle East, we think it was, there they interbred with a small number of Neanderthals. And then they took that bit of Neanderthal DNA with them as they then dispersed across the rest of the world. So Europeans, Chinese, New Guineans, Native Americans all have a little bit of Neanderthal in them. And of course, then there was another twist that turned up at the end of last year with these strange people called the Denisovans, mysterious people known only from a finger bone and a tooth in a cave in southern Siberia. Too incomplete to actually say what they looked like or what species they were. But their DNA is not Neanderthal, it's not modern human, so that's one surprise. They had a separate evolution in Asia for maybe a couple of hundred thousand years, but added on to that, their DNA is found in only one group of living people in Southeast Asia and Australasia today.
And so this idea of finding new species of humans, well, I wouldn't say regularly, but it happens recently. I mean, are you, as a researcher in this field, constantly expecting surprises now? I mean, as technology gets better, in this field. We've had archaeology, we've had fossil sort of studies. Now genomics is coming in. You can analyze very small fragments and work out whether they're one species or another. I mean, this is probably the most exciting time for this research.
Yes, I think the genomic work has made a huge impact in a short period of time. But even new discoveries can make a huge impact, and there have been many of those, of course. And we mustn't forget this weird thing over in Flores, the so-called hobbit. That creature is still causing huge arguments in the scientific community about what it really is. But I think there's increasing evidence that it's a relic of a very early stage of human evolution that got isolated over in Flores for over a million years and only died out 17,000 years ago. So new discoveries, too, are very challenging. And that shows us, really, and the Denisovan material shows us, how little we know about human evolution in Asia. I mean, we've got a lot to learn about human evolution in Africa. But when you look at the vastness of Asia, there are huge gaps in our knowledge there, which we need to fill.
And so let's look at the Homo sapiens a bit more closely then. So 60,000 years ago, we assume they left, they developed in Africa, they left Africa. And then what happened next? How did they displace Neanderthals and others? And how then did they diversify into the sort of races and looks and things that we see today?
Yeah, so I think what we can say is that there was, if you like, a kind of prototype modern human that was in Africa 100,000 years ago. And that prototype had the shared features of people around the world today. So a high rounded skull, a small brow ridge, a face tucked under the brain case, a chin on the lower jaw, a relatively lightly built skeleton, quite tall and slender. So that's the kind of prototype modern human that lived in Africa and came out of Africa. And then as that species spread out, as those modern humans spread out, yes, they made contact in some way or another with at least some of these other lineages outside of Africa. And we don't know much about the contact with some of these people. So with the hobbit, for example, over in Flores, there's no evidence at the moment that modern humans actually ever interacted with the hobbit. It died out 17,000 years ago, and it's quite likely the reason it died out was that there was a massive volcanic eruption on Flores, which devastated the island, destroyed probably most of the vegetation. So most of the flora and fauna was wiped out, and the poor old hobbit went along with that lost flora and fauna. So its food disappeared and it died out. You've got to feel sorry for it, you know, evolving away for over a million years in isolation, and then something like that happens and it comes to an end. So we've no evidence modern humans ever interacted there, although it is possible. We don't have the evidence yet. But over in Western Asia and Europe, yes, we do know that modern humans overlapped with the Neanderthals. And there have been debates, of course, for a very long time about what their interaction was, if any. There are some people who think that actually these two groups hardly met each other, if at all. Well, we now know from the genomic data they must have met each other at least once for there to be some interbreeding.
There's been something of a sort of rehabilitation for the Neanderthals in the past decade or so, hasn't there? I mean, traditionally, people might have thought of them as the stupid lumbering things that drag people around, that they're people around by hair and all of that. But actually, as you learn more about them, they're very similar to us. We interbreed with them. Their brains are big.
Well, that's right. I mean, they've had a terrible press. You know, British soccer fans behave badly. They're called Neanderthals. Yeah. And that is unfair. The Neanderthals were highly evolved humans, as you've said. Their brains were as big as ours. They walked upright as well as we do. So they were highly evolved humans. They diverged from our line of evolution maybe only 400,000 years ago, which is like yesterday, geologically speaking. So they were close relatives. And they shared many of our adaptations. But obviously, when we look at the painted caves of Europe, for example, we see something there which was done by modern humans. We've no evidence Neanderthals moved to that level of complexity in their expression. However, there is increasing evidence that Neanderthals did use pigments. So in their caves, we find pigments and often a dominance of dark pigments like manganese. And some of these have been shaped as though they're crayons. So they're obviously marking something, maybe marking their bodies, and that evidence has disappeared. So we know also that there is some expression, there are pendants, there are little bits of jewellery. So shells and animal teeth are found in Neanderthal sites with holes in them and look like they were being suspended for use as pendants, as necklaces and so on. So that's something which modern humans were doing in Africa 100,000 years ago, but Neanderthals were also doing it in Europe 50,000 years ago.
And so when was the sort of moment when the Homo sapiens was left alone in the world, I suppose, and then that the moment from which we then developed everything we have now in terms of our society, what was the sort of timescale?
Well, we think the Neanderthals died out about 30,000 years ago on present evidence, give or take, as we've said, a bit of interbreeding. The Denisovans, we have no idea what their fate was. All we've got is this finger bone and tooth dating from maybe 40,000 years ago. So we assume they were around more widely in Asia, and that's how somehow in Southeast Asia, the ancestors of modern-day Australasians interbred with them somewhere in Asia, in Southeast Asia. So we don't know how long they lasted. The Hobbit, we think, died out by 17,000 years ago. So we were probably alone then finally 17,000 years ago. And yes, after that, we get some major changes with the development of agriculture, domestication of plants and animals, increasingly sedentary lifestyle. People move from being hunter-gatherers in many parts of the world to being more settled. So these major changes happen after that time, and they have a huge impact too. And as I discuss in the book, there's a lot of data now that the evolution did not stop at that point. You know, there was a view, and it's one that I largely held probably 20 years ago, that once modern humans evolved physically, that was most of our evolution over and done with. And that's far from true. We know that there were huge changes still to come. Our bodies overall have got smaller. Our brains, scarily, have got maybe 10% smaller in the last 20,000 years. And our genes have changed greatly, because once you start putting people into these new environments in a settled life, with really quite specific diets and limited foodstuffs, packing them together with much more the possibility of spreading diseases, that also then had a huge impact on our evolution and has left its mark in our genome.
So we're continuing to evolve. It's not that after the previous humans died out, that's it. We're going to just take over.
Well, that's right. Yes. I mean, obviously, people like Steve Jones have argued that evolution is essentially over for us, at least in the developed world, because we've got medicine, we've got an all-encompassing culture that kind of means that almost everyone gets to reproductive age, and selection has effectively stopped. And I disagree with him, because a lot of the world doesn't have the benefits of the medicine and even enough food and water in many places. So disease is still rife in many areas. Selection is still hitting humanity as a whole. And even in our developed world, there is selection. There's differential survival going on. And under the surface, we all have mutations compared with our parents. So our DNA is mutating regardless. We've probably each got 50 mutations compared with our parents.
Final question I want to know was, how does your work, which you've been engaged in this work for several decades now, at the Natural History Museum, and how do people react to the kinds of things you're discovering, the stories you're telling? Because these are stories about where we all come from, and they are essentially a celebration of evolution, natural selection, of biology, of archaeology, all these things. But people normally, when it comes to these sorts of stories, don't have much of an opinion about how other things evolve. But when it comes to humans, everyone has an opinion, everyone has thoughts. Do you get much resistance? Is there more argument in human evolution than, say, other evolution stories?
Well, yes, I think the human evolution does seem to have more than its fair share of discussion, debate, dissent, for example, with the
Lots
Hobbit.
Lots of dissent.
Absolutely. I mean, within the field, obviously, even with the Hobbit, there is still a very vocal and active minority who think that this is some kind of pathological modern human and not an ancient human lineage. So there's that going on. So within the field, there's debate. I didn't get round to talking about modern diversity and how that developed, so-called regional racial diversity. But we know that that's largely a very recently evolved phenomenon. So modern humans 100,000 years ago had not yet developed the regional racial diversification. So most of that's happened too in the last 50,000 years. Some people find that very difficult to take on board. They still believe that there must be deep divisions in humanity, and these racial differences are highly significant. I tend to think that they are an add-on to the shared morphology of modern humans. It's not to say that they're not significant, of course, at some level, but they are add-ons to the story. They're details of our evolution, in a sense, rather than something fundamental. And then beyond that, of course, well, yes, there are the anti-evolution brigade, and of course human evolution is one of their strong areas to try and attack. So, yes, I get my share of abusive messages and emails from people accusing me of, you know, attacking God and so on. And some of them, you know, I've been baptized several times in America against my wishes to save my soul. So this happens, and that comes with the job, really.
Well, we'll leave it there then. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Chris Stringer there. The Origin of Our Species is out on June the 30th, and Chris has written an article for the Observer's science section, so you can check that out at guardian.co.uk/science. We're now going to sift through some of this week's big stories. To help, we have The Guardian's Ian Sample and The Observer's Robin McKee. Robin, Ian, welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hello.
Now, let's kick off with a stem cell treatment for macular degeneration, which is an eye condition. Ian, you wrote about this. Just tell us what macular degeneration is first.
This particular therapy is looking at two different types of macular degeneration. Essentially, what this is it's a condition that is caused when the central part of your retina, which is the best part for forming sort of high-resolution images, if you like, it's the bit that you get the really sort of clear images from, the cells in the retina start thinning, they start wasting away, and eventually you lose the light-sensitive cells in the retina. So over time, your vision just degrades and degrades, and you can end up with partial or sometimes even full blindness from it.
And this is one of those conditions that people are getting more and more concerned about because aging populations mean that more people will suffer from this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as the population ages, we do expect the cases of one type of this sort of macular degeneration, the age-related type, to increase. But this trial, that there are two trials actually here of the same treatment, and one of them was looking at a version that really appears in younger people, in people aged 10 to 20 typically it starts taking hold. So they're looking at the old age one, if you like, and also a much younger one.
So they use stem cells to tell us what they did with them, and tell us in the trial what are they looking for.
So what they've done is they've taken human embryonic stem cells, and that's where the sort of the controversial element comes in, I suppose, particularly for America. This is a Massachusetts-based company called Advanced Cell Technologies. They've taken human embryonic stem cells and converted those into what are called retinal pigment epithelial cells. Now, these are the cells in the retina that really give it structure, that form the retina, and it's it gives a sort of a base for these photoreceptors, the light-sensitive cells, to live, if you like, somewhere for them to be. Now, what they've done is they've done an awful lot of animal tests where if you inject these freshly created retinal pigment epithelial cells into the retina, they can repopulate it and basically replace the ones that have been dying off. Now, they've had some good results in animals. Now, it's the first time they're really going into humans to see if they get any beneficial effect in people.
The chief scientific officer at this company, Advanced Cell Technology, Robert Lanza, he's a sort of pioneer in stem cell work. He was quoted in your article as saying that this is kind of the first step in actually some of the promise of stem cells really coming to the fore. So this one's about regrowing cells for macular degeneration. But there have been other trials, and another biotech company in America is trialing neural cells as well, I think, is it, for damaged spinal cords?
Yeah, exactly. That's the. In both of these trials have been very long awaited. The eye treatment has been about 10 years in the making. But last year, last October, November, the US company Geron finally got FDA approval to put its embryonic stem cell treatment into patients who have suffered spinal cord injuries. And the hope there is that the stem cells actually help regenerate some of the nerves that have died off and help give some of those paralyzed people some movement back.
Robin, we've been waiting for this stuff for some time now, haven't we? I mean, stem cells entered the sort of vernacular as the cure-all for everything about a decade ago, and nothing much has happened. Well, lots have happened scientifically, but nothing much has happened treatment-wise. So this is great news.
Well, yes, but you still got to note that they're only just beginning to go start putting it into human beings. We've still got another 10 years to go before you see something, I would suspect. But it's the way with any new technology. It takes a long time, particularly when you're dealing with human beings and you've got all sorts of ethical constraints. But I think it sounds great.
Let's move on to something else then. Fixing the planet using engineering. Robin, there was a story last week about the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's asking scientists to look at geoengineering. Just tell us a bit more about this.
Yes, I mean, this is a set of papers that are going to be discussed at a conference in IPCC conference in Lima. And it's basically what they're asking the IPCC is to consider not just methods for reducing carbon dioxide output into the atmosphere, but ways of actually kind of sucking it back out of the atmosphere. And all sorts of sort of ideas are being proposed, which range from quite small scale practical issues, sort of just painting your roofs white. Now that doesn't suck carbon dioxide out, but it reflects heat back into the atmosphere, which is the real problem. Depositing massive quantities of iron filings into the oceans. Now that's basically just to fertilize the oceans so you get more algae.
Which can then suck out CO2.
Carbon dioxide. Blasting aerosols into the stratosphere and bioengineering crops so they're lighter color and again will reflect more sunlight back into the space. A lot of people are very worried about this because essentially what we're doing is we're slowly screwing up the planet and we're thinking of lots of other ways to put it right and we'll screw it up even more.
Well, we don't know. That's the question, isn't it? I mean, the Royal Society issued a report last year on geoengineering, and it's one of those subjects which for a long time is seen as the real fringes of science. Like, no one would consider this stuff. The first and foremost, you just stop putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But things have got so bad now that, I mean, last week, 2 weeks ago, we discussed the sort of UNFCCC chief scientist sort of saying, well, actually, we need to think about artificial trees that suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And I suppose this is this latest development in the discussions at Lima is the next step of that. In the Royal Society report, the scientists there said, look, we've got to think about some of these ideas and at least test some of them. So, I mean, I suppose, Robin, it's sensible that the UNFCCC and others and IPCC are, you know, at least going to try it out to make sure that they allay some of the fears that you've got, for example, that if you do spray aerosols into the atmosphere, it doesn't damage the climate in some other unexpected way.
Well, this is the problem. But yes, I mean, at least you should consider them. I don't think it's a bad idea in itself. At least you can consider them and then really say, look, this one's just really ridiculous. We must even begin to go down the road. For instance, one suspects dumping large amounts of iron filings in the ocean is never going to be a very good option, given this terrible state that our oceans are in. And yes, there are certain other geoengineering concepts that we should be thinking about and are thinking about. And carbon sequestration and burial is a very good one, and Britain is well placed to advance on that.
And we should taking carbon dioxide out of the waste stream of power stations, yes, and industrial plants, and burying it.
And they're already underway in Scotland at Loch Gannet. In a scheme that would dump, you know, a million tons or so in an old North Sea oil field. We should be promoting schemes like that at least to find out if they will work. They probably will, but if they're not going to work, we should know now.
Yeah. Ian?
Some of these techniques don't look actually worth testing to me, because the Earth system is so complex that you will never be able to do a small-scale pilot test that will tell you what the ultimate knock-on effects will be, I don't think. I mean, especially the irreversible ones, like putting iron filings into the oceans, firing loads of sulfate particles up into the atmosphere to try and reflect light. And it seems that when the Royal Society came out with its report, it was almost suggesting these techniques as a means of showing how ridiculous the extremes are that you have to go to try and do a kind of geoengineering project. And so it almost gives weight to the argument that you need to do something else other than those. I mean, as Robin was saying, I think the carbon capture and just removing carbon somehow from the atmosphere seems to be the sort of the winner, the only way to go, really, because at least then you can, it's reversible, you can, you know, you can switch your kit off, you can switch it on again, but you at least have some control over what you're doing.
Well, I mean, there's two things to add to that, which is that if you're going to do anything on a planet-wide scale, you need the legal structures and the governance, unfortunately, to do it. Because if you want to put enough sulfate into the atmosphere, enough sea salt, whatever, into the atmosphere to reflect away sunlight, you need to do it on a global scale. and someone is going to have to monitor that. If you want to put in enough iron filings into the oceans, then someone needs to monitor that. It can't just be done by cowboys dumping it off a boat in the Pacific somewhere. So that's an issue that I think the IPCC has to consider, the legal sort of implications, I suppose, or maybe the UNFCC rather, the body that sort of decides on all of this stuff. But there's one other thing which I suppose I could wind up with. At the press conference for the Royal Society report, one of the authors of the report, Ken Caldera of the Carnegie Institute in California, he had quite an interesting metaphor about this stuff, which was that you don't test a parachute for the first time when your plane is crashing. You've got to test it beforehand, and then in case your plane crashes, then you can use it. You don't necessarily want to use it, but then you need to know it works. Well, I wanted to end on a more positive note, but actually I've just read this story of yours, Ian, about the ladybirds, and it's not as positive as you might want to think. Alien invaders, they're destroying native good old British ladybirds. What's going on?
Well, this was a story about a survey of ladybirds in Britain and Ireland, the British Isles, you could say, over the past 20 years, looking at how different species have been rising and falling with climate change, with differences in habitat use, and also invasive species as well. So there's sort of a number of factors going on here. And the general picture, we've got essentially 47 different species of ladybird in Britain, and they're sort of pretty iconic of the British countryside. Now, the survey showed that about more than a fifth actually are in decline, 10 out of the 47, with five different species increasing their numbers. And It shows a real changing picture of where these insects are living. A ladybird called the 13 spot ladybird that was pretty much thought extinct in Britain has actually recolonized, probably from France and the Channel Islands, in Cornwall, Devon and the New Forest. So that had vanished and then has come back over, probably surviving after coming over on sort of car ferries or even wind currents from that sort of distance. There is one species that will get some blame, and that's the harlequin ladybird, which came over in 2003 from continental Europe. Now, this was originally an Asian species that was introduced to try and do some pest control. And as is often the case it does its job a little too well. The harlequin ladybird has a voracious appetite. It outbreeds and out-eats a lot of the ladybirds over here, and particularly the two-spot ladybird over here has been suffering.
But I think it's very interesting that, particularly the harlequin story, because, I mean, we were discussing the previous items about the dangers of unintended consequences, and there you have a classic example of it there, just with this with the ladybird, introduced to control pests. What's it done? Taken over the southern half of the country and is eradicating the two-spot ladybird.
Well, invasive species in general, actually, is one of those things that I know that the UN has put on its list of most devastating things happening to the ecology of the planet.
Yeah.
All over the world. I mean, Japanese knotweed we know about in this country, and you know, fish going from one place to another, out competing things where there's no natural predators. It's a really big issue. I mean, the ladybirds one might sound not as important as some of the other ones, but it's the problem is that our local species, I suppose, disappear in the end.
I just say why we care, because I think
care.
It's often something that comes up in these stories is, are you writing this simply because ladybirds are a little bit cute and we tend to like them?
Now, good pictures.
But ladybirds are actually, within their sort of ecological niches, are top predators, and they eat larvae. They eat lots of larvae of pests that destroy the plants that we want to have around us. So certainly gardeners love them a lot. But if you get rid of the ladybirds, then a lot of these other pests, the insect pests, the scale insects and so on, the really tiny ones, are going to flourish.
And can I just salute amateur gardeners here? Because they're the ones who collected most of this data that worked all this out.
How do they spot the difference between a 10 and a 14 spot ladybirds? Who the hell's counting?
People in the south can count, Robin.
They've run out of fingers when they get to 14. Don't give me that.
That's right. I'm not sure what it's like in Glasgow. But
we don't get ladybirds, sonny boy.
That's right. Well, you will soon. Anyway, for more on any of that stuff, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science. And now, the Hannaford question.
My name's Professor Paul Riley. I work at University College London, Institute of Child Health, in stem cell research and cardiovascular. And the burning question I have is, how did the initial organic compounds all come together in the sea of life to form life?
The great northern town of Sheffield used to be associated with stainless steel and quality spoons. These days, though, it's an international destination for documentary filmmakers. The Sheffield Dockfest, in association with The Guardian, took place recently, and a key part was the Wellcome Trust Broadcast Development Awards. These set out to fund great science documentaries and to give scientists themselves a front row seat on the process of pitching film ideas. In the studio with me now are filmmaker Julia Barron, who won some of the Wellcome Trust funding, and Professor Ian Roberts, an expert in public health, and one of the team of scientists who was allowed to watch the science documentary pitching sessions unfold. Julia, let's start with you. What is the burden of TB in the world today?
Well, it's a massive burden, killing at least 2 million people a year. But we're interested much more in the multi-drug-resistant aspects of tuberculosis than tuberculosis itself. And within that burden, the percentage or proportion of people dying of multi-drug resistant TB is ever increasing. And the reason is pretty self-evident. We are unable to treat it. Therefore, more people are going to die of it when they contract it.
And so your the film that you've won development funding for, can you just explain what story you want to tell in that? What is it about this particular form of TB that's important?
Yeah, the story is absolutely centred in this country and in London, which is now the TB capital of Europe for its sins. And it's got a much higher burden of drug-resistant TB, which makes experts think that we're about to have a really unpleasant spike of the disease here and quite high mortality. A bit akin to the 1990s in New York, when a few hundred people died, and it cost about $1 billion to isolate and clean up. So that's the danger that we're facing here, but also in London, it's one of the centres of excellence for trying to work out new ways to combat multi-drug resistant TB. So for those two reasons, it's very much centred here. But we also want in the documentary to go to some of the countries like South Africa and India, where there's a really, really pressing problem, to attempt in very broad terms to get this onto much higher up the public agenda in this country.
Why is London such a centre for it?
Well, I'm nailed on the head. I mean, a lot of it is to do with immigrant populations coming in with the disease. But what we're seeing increasingly, if you speak to doctors in the East End of London, is that people in difficult a lot of poverty, quite difficult housing conditions. There's increased prevalence of people who are born here catching the disease from particularly immigrant populations coming in. So it's starting to become an indigenous disease again today. We have to remember, we got rid of the inoculation for TB. We stopped doing that in 2005. We thought we had it licked. I mean, they now think they're going to have to reintroduce it to London. So we're saying that the disease is at a point where it's about to start tipping into being a real issue here.
Ian, Julia's documentary is going to try and address a really contentious but very important issue. I mean, you're trained as a doctor and an epidemiologist. But how do you benefit from seeing complex stories like this told in documentary form?
I think the making documentaries about science is really interesting. I mean, it can be good entertainment, but also it sort of creates what science comes to mean for the public, and I think that's both an opportunity and a risk. Because what we present to the public as science is not just science, it's selection. And that selection is based on all sorts of things, ideology, gender, a whole variety of different things. I saw Julia's pitch and I thought it was brilliant, and it doesn't surprise me that she won. And she made the point just now, it's not all about technology dealing with tuberculosis. It's not all about new drugs. She identified herself that one of the biggest issues is poverty. So poverty is a public health issue as well. But it wouldn't. Many scientists wouldn't think poverty is a scientific issue. Well, it truly is. It's a major cause of disease all around the world.
You say that you said at the earlier there that the way that people see science and interpret it in their lives is mediated through things like documentary. I mean, is that something that scientists themselves recognize?
I think it is to some extent. I mean, there is a clamor among scientists for a share of voice from the media, because they know that actually if you get your science into the media, that is a sort of, it's a feedback loop, and that your science will become lifted up from the background and more likely to be funded. So there's a certain sort of self-interest among scientists about getting their science into the media. A lot of it's quite dishonest, I believe. For example, you get lots of scientists saying, this experiment on a mouse holds out the cure for cancer. Complete rubbish. You know, a cure for asthma might be right round the corner. Utter nonsense. We've heard it for decades. But they do that because it's in their interests to do that. So there's a lot of hyping up of science because it's in scientists' interests.
Julia, as Ian said, your documentary is about poverty, it's about science, it's about society. How difficult is it to weave those things together to make something? Ultimately, you have to make something compelling and entertaining to some extent.
Very, very easy answer. I mean, characters are everything. So the real point about why this award is so crucial for us is that that's what the commissioners need. I mean, you know, you could, otherwise this is just another worthy subject that somebody's trying to get on the telly. But what we need is characters. And there are some incredible doctors out there doing extraordinary things against all the odds. That's what makes TV. It's human stories and patients as well with extraordinary
and
stories.
And who is the sort of central scientist in your story?
The scientist here is a professor called Professor Lalvani, who's based at St. Mary's, and he is doing some extraordinary. He's got one of the biggest multi-drug resistant wards for patients, which is obviously one side of it for us. But he's also doing some really interesting genetic research to try and work out the thing. One of the things about TB is that the same people can be breathed on by the same actively tuberculosis person, but not everyone's going to get the disease. So he's trying to look at the genetic level as to what differentiates individuals in terms of their susceptibility to both getting and then dying of the disease. Some people get it and they cure themselves. So he's, instead of going down the drug route, he's trying to go completely back to kind of molecule one basis and try and find out what makes us different. So for two reasons, both because obviously we need to find some extraordinary patient stories, and because we want to highlight some of this new science, he's really crucial to our story.
I mean, how complex can you go with a documentary like this?
Because fantastic with CGI. I mean, there's no limit. I mean, you know, a fantastic director. There is no limit to what you can explain. There's all sorts.
So you're not of the mindset that TV has to be really, really simple to make people interested.
No, I think actually in some ways, there's lots of simple TV out there, but I think in some ways, a lot of the audience research is now showing that people do want things that are more complex. I mean, the Brian Cox series, I mean, some of it's done in very simple ways, but the ideas in it are extremely complex, and that had millions watching it on a weekly basis.
Ian, when you were watching the stories being pitched at the documentary festival, were you sort of impressed by the depth of the science, or did you think, some of the stuff's typical TV stuff? Be honest.
No, some of it was very... I think there were... There were some excellent pitches, and the best ones were like Julia's, that you could see the kind of visual narrative. I think communicating science is about narrative. I completely agree about that. But I do see that it's a sort of an ideological issue. It's a political issue. What we perceive of as science is not without values. For example, if we take the tuberculosis example, one of the big things that's happening in India is it's motorizing really quickly. So the whole Indian population is grinding to a halt in terms of personal physical activity. They're getting into cars and they're getting fatter. Now, this is leading to an epidemic of obesity and diabetes. And diabetes is a major risk factor for tuberculosis. So it's all interrelated. How we live and our diseases are really related. But if we think that some molecule is exciting and whole populations getting fat unexciting, then I think that's a problem. But if we can make both these stories exciting, then I think we're communicating science.
Have you, in watching all these things and getting excited by other bits of science, have you decided that there's any subject of yours that you wouldn't mind having a documentary treatment for?
Oh, yes. I'm really fascinated about movement or the lack of it.
Yeah.
I think the whole, pretty much the whole population of the world is grinding to a halt. We spend most of our time sitting down. We're sitting down in our offices. We're sitting down in our transport. People are moving their bodies less than ever before. So I was up there at this documentary festival to see how the media could be used to try and get the population moving. Now, I'm not sure if it's the best medium because it involves people watching television.
You can watch it on treadmills. Yeah,
you could do, maybe.
The TV doesn't work unless
you're... So maybe it's about music and dance and theatre. But, you know, I lecture to students at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and 200 students sitting in front of me, sitting in front of me, while I'm telling them how important movement is. It just seems not right. So I'm looking for better ways to communicate movement.
Julie, you've got an idea for another documentary, surely, there. At least two or three.
I'll see you after.
What's the next step for your film, then? When do we start to see the fruits of your labour?
We'll get cracking on the development as soon as possible. And what we'll get from that is a taste of the tape with characters that we can then go to the commissioners, both here and in the States. So, you know, we'd already tried them. I mean, it is difficult for me, and I do understand their position. It's very hard in these, you know, difficult times to financially commit to expensive films abroad. So, you know, it's amazing that something like the Wellcome Trust can step in and help us with that. But we will end up with an amazing taster tape that we can take to commissioners, and, you know, fingers crossed we'll get it commissioned and hopefully on the air for the 30th World TB Day next March. That's the aim.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Professor Ian Roberts and to Julia Barron there. For more information on the Wellcome Trust Broadcast Awards, go to their website, wellcome.ac.uk/funding. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye. See you next week for more.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.